You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Clive Stone was 81 when he died on June 18, 1989. Although he'd spent most of his life as a self-described radical journalist and author, he'd won the respect of his colleagues and numerous awards for his excellent reporting. His career spanned the New Deal, World War II, McCarthyism, the Cold War, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Civil Rights Movement, the Vietnam War, and beyond, and he was not one to shy away from controversy. He aroused the ire and suspicion of the FBI, Congress, and at one point his work and political views made him unemployable even by the nation. He's the subject of a new book called American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone by D.D. Guttenplan, the London correspondent for The Nation. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Guttenplan back to our show today. Hi, good to see you again.
Great to be here.
You begin with a crucial appearance by I.F. Stone on Meet the Press, which began as a radio show in the 1940s, and he was a regular guest on both the radio show and then the TV show, and then not invited back for 18 years.
Well, the interesting thing is that the radio audience in Meet the Press was much more important than the TV audience all through the 40s. But I start my book in 1949 when he was on the program with Dr. Morris Fishbein, who in those days was the most famous doctor in America. He was the editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And he was a critic of the president's plans for health care reform.
It was Harry Truman's plans.
That's right. The
president, not Barack Obama's.
Well, I mean, the point I make at the beginning of the book is that what Stone did is he said to Fishbein, look, the president is in favor of national health insurance for everybody in America. In your view, does that make him a deluded fellow traveler or a dangerous communist? And the interesting point about that was, first of all, that was the last time I.F. Stone was on national television for 18 years. It was another 18 years before he was on I.F.
Because sarcasm was not appreciated?
Because I think he was too radical for mainstream media. He was never again invited back on Meet the Press, even though he was very famous in the 1980s before he died. And, you know, even then the culture of Sunday morning chat shows was established, but he was never invited back.
Well, Fishbein is the one who gave us the whole idea of creeping socialism in connection with any kind of national health plan, and that's pretty much been the way it's been treated ever since.
Well, that's, in a way, the other point about it that I think is even more significant is that the debate on health care, you know, I wrote the opening of my book a year and a half ago, so I had no idea that it was going to be quite so timely. But what's amazing is how little the debate on healthcare has moved in 60 years, and I think that's what happens when you exclude radicals from the national conversation.
In addition to challenging the conventional wisdom on healthcare, wasn't I.F. Stone at the forefront of confronting McCarthyism way before Edward R. Murrow?
Well, yes. First of all, Stone always liked to call it Trumanism because he pointed out that the whole Red Scare in the United States, although it was in some ways a Republican Party project, was made huge by President Truman's loyalty security program, so that was the first instance in which the federal government decided that it could use hearsay evidence, use gossip to fire people and not allow them to confront the witnesses against them.
Well, he worked for left-leaning publications, PM, and he worked for The Nation, but wasn't The Nation scared off of him during the McCarthy years?
Well, what happened is he'd been fired from The Nation in 1946 for going to, he wrote a book called Underground to Palestine, in which he was the first journalist to run the British blockade of Palestine, starting with DP camps in Europe and going with the refugees on an illegal ship to Haifa. And he wasn't allowed to tell his bosses at The Nation what he was doing. I think the Haganah thought there might be a British spy at The Nation. So he wasn't allowed to tell them. He did tell Ralph Ingersoll, who was the editor of PM. But when he got to Palestine and he wrote front page stories for PM every day that pushed the paper's circulation into the profitable zone for the first time in the paper's history, The Nation fired him. However, he did stay on good terms with The Nation. But in 1952, he worked for PM, and then PM closed, and he worked for The Star and The Daily Compass. The Daily Compass closed down. It was located not very far from here, and it closed down on the corner of Hudson and Duane. It closed down Election Day 1952, and Stone wrote, he was sitting in the newsroom, an empty city room. He sat at his desk, and he started to type, and he wrote, "I feel for the moment like a ghost." He was unemployable, and not even The Nation would give him a job.
And so he started his own publication.
That's right. Having no choice, he decided to strike out on his own, and he started I.F. Stone's Weekly. He started out with 4,500 subscribers. And interestingly, that was not enough to make it profitable or even pay its expenses, but it was enough to almost pay its expenses. And by the end of the first year, it was profitable. And he used essentially what was left of the PM audience, so that part of what's I think is different about my biography, because there have been other Stone biographies before, is that I notice and emphasize how much Stone's New York roots. He was born in Philadelphia and grew up in New Jersey, but his professional roots were in New York. He was the editorial writer of the New York Post at the age of 25. His New York roots and his New York audience were, in a sense, what sustained him and made I.F. Stone's Weekly possible. And in fact, I.F. Stone's Weekly, although it came out from Washington for 19 years, its first office was on Broadway.
Did he become respectable again?
Well, he has told his wife, he said, if I survive long enough, I'll go from being a pariah to a character to a national institution.
I want to play a little clip from March 22nd, 1988, which is, a little over a year before he dies.
That's right.
Here he is on the McNeil Lehrer Hour, and he was asked about the state of free speech in America in 1988.
Well, free speech has always had to battle in every society and every age, and in fact in every group. Even little coteries of radicals have their party line, and if you go against it, well, you find your freedom of speech looked at askance. But if you look at it objectively, in large terms, we have a tradition that is more powerful than that of any other Western society when it comes to freedom of speech. Our Whigs were, unlike the British Whigs of the 17th century, were the children of the French Enlightenment, and not afraid to utter large and potentially explosive generalities about the equality of man, about freedom.
So here's a man who many people think is critical of the American way of life, has been called every kind of negative thing by people on the right. He's saying America's a great place. We have more free speech than any other place in the world.
Well, he believed that, and he said that it made his life possible. I mean, he always used to say that if it wasn't for the fact that even at the height of McCarthyism, he could get a second-class mail permit, which meant that he could save a few pennies on mailing out each copy of I.F. Stone's Weekly. That was the difference between survival and failure.
I'd like to read what Peter Jennings said the night that Izzy Stone died. They called him Izzy, right?
Even That's right.
His name was...
He was born Isidore Feinstein, and in 1937, he was scared about the rise of fascism in Europe and also in the U.S., and also, I think, wanted to protect his children from antisemitism. So he changed his name to I.F. Stone, and I think he always felt a little bad about it. But anyway, he was known throughout the whole... He never changed what he was known by to his friends, which was always Izzy.
Well, you call yourself by your first two initials as well.
I do, but I did before I knew about I.F. Stone.
And you're not going to reveal what the DD stands for?
Oh, if you push me far enough.
It's okay. If you want to, you can. If you don't, it's not the most important thing that we will address today. But I want to read what Peter Jennings said, or at least part of what he said. Finally this evening, a brief word about the journalist and author I.F. Stone. He had a truly profound effect on the practice of journalism in America. He always succeeded in prompting other people to think. Sometimes they agreed, sometimes they were outraged, but there was no avoiding a connection with Stone's intellect and passion. For many people, it's a rich experience to read or reread Stone's views on America's place in the world, on freedom, on the way government works and sometimes corrupts. Stone thought journalism was all about, in his words, to write the truth, to defend the weak against the strong, to fight for justice, to bring healing perspectives to bear on the terrible hates and fears of mankind, in the hope of someday bringing about a world in which men will enjoy the differences of the human garden instead of killing each other over them. If you look, you'll find much more. Was that a brave thing for Peter Jennings to do, considering Izzy Stone's radical credentials?
Well, you might think so, except that Stone was eulogized on all four of the then, there were four network newscasts, and all four of them devoted time to his death. Nobody quite as warmly as Jennings. Interestingly, Jennings was attacked for it afterwards and remains even posthumously attacked for having said that about Stone. So I suppose there are some people who'll never forgive it. But in a way, Stone was right in that by the time he died, he had become a national institution. He had become a character. And he used to say that people will, even in the 50s, people would point to him and say, look, it can't be that bad because there's Izzy Stone. He's still putting out the Weekly. So, you know, how bad can America be?
My guest is D.D. Guttenplan. His book, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone, it's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. He started his first newspaper when he was 14 years old. This is a guy who always wanted to be a journalist?
He always wanted to be not just a journalist, but a newspaper man. He was very much a print journalist.
I wonder what he would think about the current situation.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. One of the things I remember talking to Norman Perlstein, who was the editor-in-chief of Time magazine and now is at Bloomberg, and who said that somebody gave him a subscription to I.F. Stone's Weekly when he was in high school and it changed his life. And we were trying to figure out what the message for today's journalists would be from I.F. Stone's life and work. And one thing we drew from it is that you shouldn't give away your content. That it's interesting. What Stone did is he knew he had an audience who would pay to hear what he had to say. It might have been a small audience, but it grew steadily so that by the 1960s, he had 20,000 readers. And then when the Vietnam War started and people realized that Stone was telling a truth about the war that nobody else was telling, his readership shot up so that by the time he shut down in 1971, he had 70,000 subscribers.
His sister also has been a journalist and a film critic, Judy Stone.
That's right. In fact, he had two brothers who were also journalists.
But he studied philosophy.
Well, he studied philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania and dropped out because he was working at the Inquirer as a copy editor and making $40 a week, which was a lot of money in 1926. But then he went to work for the Philadelphia Record and the Camden Courier, two papers that were owned by a muckraking publisher called David Stern. He quit that job, though, in 1927 because he wanted to cover the executions of Sacco and Vanzetti, and Stern wouldn't let him go. So he walked out of the newsroom and walked off the job.
Did he have a flirtation with Stalinism?
I would say he had a flirtation with communism. I wouldn't say it was a flirtation with Stalinism, but he came very close to the American Communist Party line in the 1930s. I would say that it was really a series of accidents that prevented him from joining the party in 1933. He once wrote under the pseudonym Abelard Stone before he became I.F. Stone that the election of Franklin Roosevelt closed the road to a Soviet America. But the interesting thing about that phrase, which has been used by his detractors, is that he published it in a magazine called Modern Monthly, which the Communist Party attacked as a Trotskyist rag. So even when he became, in a way, closest to communism, he was already moving in the other direction.
So I assume you don't think that he ever worked for Soviet intelligence, which has been claimed over the years, including quite recently. There have been a new series of attacks on I.F. Stone.
That's right. Now, I think if you look at Stone's writing and you look at the context each time these charges are raised, you realize not only is it ridiculous to charge that he worked for Soviet intelligence, it's ridiculous to charge that I.F. Stone ever took instructions from anybody else. I mean, if you had to sum him up in a word apart from radical, it would be insubordinate. He was just not very good at taking orders.
But the FBI tracked him, and I'm sure others as well. Were you able to get the files?
Yes. In fact, one of the things that I was working at Newsday when Stone died, and I filed a Freedom of Information request in July 1989. Stone died in June 1989. And one of the things that set me on the path to writing this biography is when I found out that his FBI file was 6,000 pages long. Just to give you an idea, Al Capone's file was about 2,000 pages long. So obviously the FBI considered him a dangerous character.
So you knew everything he did on a Thursday in 1938, what he ate at dinner that night.
Not in 1938, but interestingly in the 1950s, in fact, exactly when he was starting I.F. Stone's Weekly, he was under daily surveillance. So yeah, I get a pretty good resume of the best Chinese restaurants and Jewish delis in Washington because those were the places he liked to go.
Wasn't he among the first reporters to suggest that the Gulf of Tonkin was really just a ruse to get the United States involved in Vietnam?
No, he wasn't among the first. He was the only reporter to suggest it at a time when everybody else, every other mainstream reporter, and even most left-wing reporters were just reporting what Johnson said. In I.F. Stone's Weekly, Stone said that, first of all, we discussed every possibility about the Gulf of Tonkin except that those attacks were provoked. And secondly, and this is typical of Stone's method, he noticed, he looked at the evidence, he looked at the Pentagon situation reports, And he saw that in one of the supposed attacks, there was no debris in the water. There was no damage to the ship. So he said, what makes us think this attack ever happened? He wrote those words in August 1964. They were confirmed by the Pentagon Papers in 1971. But in 1964, nobody else said that.
And he remained a person of the left anyway, what we might call a progressive today, to the end. Often people become more conservative over the years. He was critical of the Reagan administration in the end. He had been a fighter for civil rights throughout most of the civil rights movement. Period.
Well, he was critical of the Reagan administration. He was critical of the Carter administration. He was critical of the Kennedy administration.
And he called Truman, he blamed Truman on McCarthyism.
Well, he said that the Truman era was the era of the wimpy, when politicians could be bought for the price of a hamburger. The interesting thing is he was a radical and an unabashed radical to the end of his life, but he was not one of those radicals for whom nothing is ever good enough. He was the kind of radical who would take yes for an answer and who believed that in order for things to change, radicals and liberals had to work together.
Why do you think he still angers people today?
I think he angers... I've thought about this
It's 21 years since he died.
It's 20 years since he died. He died in June 89.
Okay.
And I think it's because his example is still inspiring to young people, and also because he's dangerous. As he used to say that he described himself as a Jeffersonian Marxist. So he was someone who saw no contradiction between the freedom of expression enshrined in the First Amendment and in the Declaration of Independence, and who considered himself very much a lover of the United States, but who also remained a socialist his whole life. And I think it suits the right to try and cast all radicals as, in some sense, foreign tools or under the influence of a foreign ideology. Stone's radicalism sprang from American soil, and that's what makes it dangerous to the right, and that's why they have to keep attacking him.
D.D. Guttenplan is a London correspondent for The Nation, author of The Holocaust on Trial, which brought him to this show some years back. His latest book is The Life and Times of I.F. Stone. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.